distribution centers to pick up free groceries. Activists say that food banks are under extra pressure ahead of the upcoming holidays as requests have skyrocketed. They say that millions of Americans are barely making ends meet and need help to feed their families. Moreover, data by the U.S. Census Bureau indicate that more Americans are going hungry than at any point during the COVID-19 pandemic. The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.7%, which, while better than previous months, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs have been lost. Economists have said that the jobs that have not returned by this point will be the hardest to claw back, because they're concentrated in the industries most affected by virus containment measures, like leisure, travel, and hospitality. This means that employment gains that people saw during Trump's presidency may not continue at the same pace under Biden. That is because prolonged unemployment, especially in a weak labor market, can be harder to fix. Analysts say that people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Moreover, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of unemployment is growing fast across America. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That is a ratio not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted the labor market would recover by the year 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended their recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later. In the meantime, there are those who believe the mass vaccination can make real change, but it could be months until the jabs are widely distributed.
Until a certain proportion within the population is not immunized, the impact of the vaccine cannot be visible. For instance, we have to vaccinate at least 70 out of 100 people to achieve the herd immunity. At that point, we will start seeing the benefit of the vaccine in breaking the transmission. Although the U.S. has urged to have 100 million doses in the first quarter of 2021, but even if that is started, what we're looking is that August, September would be the time when we will have the herd immunity in the United States. At that point, we will start seeing positive impact on. But before that, it is unfortunate, very grim situation.
As the world advances in its technological capabilities, so too then does the way in which various countries across the world need to protect its assets, particularly when it comes to data, information, and national security through the medium of computer-based hosts. The US has recently stated that it's become victim to yet another highly sophisticated cyber attack on its infrastructure, in particular with the attack aimed at multiple ministries across the US government, and more worryingly for the US, it seems that although discovered, the attack is still ongoing. Some of the departments have come out and announced that their systems have been breached at the Departments of Energy, the Treasury, and the Department of Commerce. At this stage, it's not clear which other departments have been hacked into, although there are reports that the National Nuclear Security Administration, which maintains the country's nuclear stockpile, has also been broken into. The US authorities have yet to admit that other more sensitive departments have also been targeted. The hacking appears to have started in March, targeting the Texas-based network security firm SolarWinds via their so-called Orion software, which was incidentally used by a host of US federal agencies and departments. It's unknown at this point as to just how serious the breaches have been, how much information has been obtained by the hackers, or what kind of information has been taken. But what is known is that some 18,000 people have uploaded the SolarWinds Orion update, loaded with the software, allowing the hackers in via the back door, a highly embarrassing situation for the US government. So does this incident suggest that the US is lagging behind in their capability when it comes to preventing such hacks? For a start, the US Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, has suffered a huge blow to their reputation, raising the speculation as to whether the US are becoming weaker or whether the hackers as simply getting smarter.
I think it's the latter. I think the hacking abilities have improved. And there's been a proliferation of a lot of private hacking entities, companies, corporations, et cetera, which have proved quite adept when it comes to penetrating the most tightly guarded software facilities.
The priority for the US will now involve securing their cyberspace infrastructure and making sure that the damage done does not cost them too dearly. With more and more states becoming ever more aware and capable when it comes to cyber warfare, the US now have to contemplate who the authors of the cyber attack were and why they targeted the US in the way they did. After all, the US have a host of adversaries around the world. In typical fashion, the Americans have already pointed their fingers towards Moscow as the perpetrators of the attack, claiming that the technology can only have come from a sophisticated source backed by a state. However, the Russians have nonsensed the US claims, stating they do not participate in such acts. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has been quoted as stating that the US should not put the blame of their own failures on Russia, claiming that Russia will not stand by and be blamed for anything and everything the US decides it needs a scapegoat for. With Russia being blamed then, could the future of warfare between sovereign states turn to cyber-based attacks and hence see an elevation in frequency and sophistication in the near future?
Yeah, this is a big problem. I mean, attribution is very difficult. It's very difficult to figure out who was behind these attacks. And that's a big problem, because if there's a major disruption, a major attack in the US, and say, you know, power grids go out or emergency services are cut off or whatever, there'll be enormous pressure to retaliate. And therefore, the US could respond in kind to Russia only to discover months later that it really wasn't Russia at all.
With the White House and Donald Trump remaining eerily silent so far, the US President-elect Joe Biden has come forward, stating that significant funds will be generated during his presidency to disrupt and deter adversaries in targeting the US through cyber attacks. With cyber warfare fast becoming the new norm in global security issues, it seems that across the world, states need to both prepare themselves for cyber attacks and use the technique to secure an advantage over others as fifth generation warfare fast becomes a new tool of the state. But more worryingly for all is the notion that individuals and lone actors are also capable and in fact more dangerous when it comes to security breaches in national security through the medium of cyber attacks. So next time you're on your computer, be careful. You have been warned.
In the limelight.
President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr. accused President Trump on Tuesday of irrational downplaying of the widespread hack of the federal government and American industries, saying the current administration was denying him intelligence and warning Russia that he would not allow the intrusion to go unanswered after he takes office. This assault happened on Donald Trump's watch when he wasn't watching, Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 22nd of December, at a news conference in Wilmington, Delaware. It is still his responsibility as president to defend American interests for the next 4 weeks. But rest assured that even if he does not take it seriously, I will. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times columnist David Sanger and Nicole Perlroth. The piece is titled, Biden Assails Trump Over Handling of Russia Hacking. President-elect Joe Biden accused President Donald Trump on Tuesday of irrational downplaying of the widespread hack of the federal government and American industry, saying the current administration was denying him intelligence and warning Russia that he would not allow the intrusion to go unanswered after he takes office. This assault happened on Donald Trump's watch when he wasn't watching, Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 22nd of December, at a news conference in Wilmington, Delaware. It is still his responsibility as president to defend American interests for the next 4 weeks, but rest assured that even if he does not take it seriously, I will. The direct critique was a remarkable departure from tradition, in which incoming presidents are careful about not second-guessing the actions of the incumbent. But President Trump's refusal to recognize Joe Biden's election victory and his effort to subvert the results has clearly poisoned elements of the transition process. In recent days, Mr. Biden's aides have come to realize that the scope of the cyber attack, which landed the Russians inside the email system used by top Treasury officials and gave them access to the networks of the Energy, Commerce, and Homeland Security departments and dozens of American companies, could pose a threat in the first days of the new administration. Joe Biden indirectly acknowledged as much when asked about his statement that he could not ensure that government systems could be trusted when he takes office. "Of course I can't," he said. "I don't know what the state of them is. They're clearly not safe right now." Privately, members of his staff have said that whilst they received briefings on the subject, they had been minimal. And the shutdown of recent cooperation between the transition team and the Defense Department has encompassed the National Security Agency and the United States Cyber Command. The quasi-civilian and military sides of the nation foreign offensive and defensive operations. "There's still so much we don't know, including the full scale of the breach or the extent of the damage it has caused," Mr. Biden said. He was alluding to the quiet internal warnings that Russia may have been able to place so-called backdoors in government systems and, in the worst case, manipulate data or sabotage systems. "It was carried out by using sophisticated cyber tools, and the attacker succeeded in catching the federal government off guard and unprepared," Mr. Biden said. Unlike Mr. Trump, the president-elect left no doubt that he believed Russia was responsible, noting that both Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Attorney General William Barr had said as much publicly, even if Donald Trump would not. And Mr. Biden said once there was a formal determination of responsibility, a task that could take intelligence agencies weeks, "we will respond and probably respond in kind." That vow is likely to prove easier to issue from the stage in Delaware than it will be to execute from the Situation Room. Joe Biden's first encounter with President Vladimir Putin of Russia will be on another topic. The two men will have 16 days to negotiate an extension of up to 5 years of New START, the nuclear arms control treaty that expires in early February. That will force Mr. Biden to strike a deal to prevent one threat, a nuclear arms race, while simultaneously threatening retaliation on another. Moreover, while the United States is awash in digital targets, Russia is a far less connected society, making an in-kind response more difficult. And it is hardly a state secret that the United States already spies on Russian systems and has turned off computers at the Internet Research Agency, the Kremlin-backed disinformation group that has involved in election interference in 2016. The New York Times reported last year that the United States had implanted malware into Russia's electric power grid as a warning to Moscow that the discovery that Russia had done the same to the American national power grid. Of course, the U.S. intelligence community does these every day and twice on Sundays, said Dmitry Alperovich, the chairman of the think tank Silverado Policy Accelerator and the former chief technology officer of the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike, where he specialized in Russian cyber operations. Dmitry Alperovich added, "We have all used supply chain attacks and we can't say it's okay for us and not for others," he said on Deep State Radio, a podcast. In fact, the Russians often cite such operations to argue that American outrage over espionage and even more extensive cyber attacks is manufactured. Joe Biden said that the United States should be getting together with our allies to try to set up an international system that will constitute appropriate behavior in cyberspace and hold any other country liable for breaking out of those basic rules. Those efforts are hardly new. President Barack Obama tried a basic agreement with President Xi Jinping of China late in his term in office, after the Chinese were caught removing 22.5 million security clearance files from the Office of Personnel Management, another hacking that went largely undetected for a year. The accord quickly fell apart after Barack Obama left office. But the more immediate problem for President-elect Joe Biden may be finding and securing vulnerable elements of the software supply chain that Russia exploited when it bought into network management software made by SolarWinds, an Austin, Texas company, and corrupted its updates with malware. That is one of several ways Russia is believed to have entered such an array of agencies and corporations. During the investigation into the Russian hacking, the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency released a report based on a two-year, still unfinished review of the risks to the United States of a supply chain attack. The report concluded that supply chain risks could have far-reaching and potentially devastating impacts. An understatement, as the government feverishly digs through its systems for evidence of Russian compromise.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
to the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Last Savior, only on IRIB English Radio. I have Mr. Kerimi with me in the studio, as always, and we've been discussing the issue of false dreams, on which false claimants base their claim regarding being either the last imam of the end of times or one of his deputies. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brother.
Alaikum assalam.
Last we left off, we were talking about a hadith that indicate the devil cannot appear as the infallibles in anyone's dreams, yet these dreams exist. So what are we supposed to do with that existing ahadith on this matter?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As we mentioned in the previous program, there are many such narrations in Sunni collections of hadiths, but when it comes to Shia collection of hadiths, we have only a few such narrations. We can divide seeing the Satan in the dream in the form of the imams or the prophet in two categories. Sometimes it happens for the people who lived at the time of the prophet and the imam, so they knew the face of the prophet and they knew the face of the imam, and then when they saw the dream, they were sure that this is the prophet, this is the imam. So there was no doubt about, recognizing the imam and the prophet. But secondly, it's about our time from the major occultation or minor occultation. We have not seen the prophet, we have not seen the imams. And then we see a dream, in it we are told that this is the prophet, or that person introduces himself as the prophet. So we have to distinguish between the two. In some narrations, we see that some people come to the infallible imam or the prophet, and they tell the imam or the prophet that we saw you in the dream. And sometimes the dreams are confirmed by the imam. For example, a man comes to Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, and he says that last night I saw a dream, and in it I asked you, how long will I live from now? And with your hand, you refer to the number of 5. So the dream disturbed me, as if the man has thought that he will live for maybe 5 days or 5 years or whatever. Now, so the imam explains the dream. He says that what you saw in the dream is something which is known only by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the narration. This is in the Harun Anwar, volume 58, page 160. Now, the first point that we can get from this narration, and this is very, very important, is the fact that it is true that sometimes people see the imam or see the prophet, and they have a kind of conversation with the imam or with the prophet. But the next step is the interpretation of that dream.
Right.
In this narration, the man sees the imam, and his understanding of the dream is that he will live for 5 days. That is why he says that the dream disturbed me. But imam says that no, this is not the case. This is not the way you interpreted the dream. And at the end of the day, it is only known by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the life of the people. This is a very important point. So those people who claim that we have seen the prophet, we have seen the imam, and they told us that you have to follow this, let's say, Ahmed from Basra, for example.
Mm.
How do you come to this conclusion that this is the interpretation of the dream? In one of the previous programs, I mentioned what happened to Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi when he began to go from Kufa to fight against Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. He heard a call, a heavenly call, even it was not in a dream.
Mm.
He was told that Abshir bil Jannah, we are giving you the glad tidings of going to paradise.
Oh my goodness, that must have been so confusing.
Yeah, it was very confusing. Of course, it was not confusing for him at that time. He thought that he's receiving these glad tidings because he's going to fight Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam.
This is the right way.
But when he repented, he came to this conclusion that this is the true interpretation of that heavenly call, you see? So it happens while he was awake. When it comes to the dreams, at least it is the same. Mm-hmm. We are not sure, even if we see the prophet or the imam, we are not sure about the interpretation. So this is the first point, that even if we see the prophet or the imam, at least we are not sure whether we can interpret the dreams as we saw. The second point about this narration is that it is about a person who has seen the imam when he was awake. So now when he sees the imam in the dream, he is sure that he is not seeing any other person other than the imam, because already he has seen the imam.
Right.
So for him, he is not Satan. I mean, the image is that of the imam. So it is different from our time. We cannot claim that, okay, we have seen a person and we are sure that he was Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. We are not sure, we have not seen the imam. In this narration, the narrator is talking about a situation in which he already has seen the imam, and now he is explaining the dream. This is the second point. The third point, when it comes to the chain of the narration, the chain has not been mentioned except for one, and that narrator is a Sunni narrator, so we cannot rely on this narration. And the last point about this narration is that the conclusion of this narration is that the imams, they do not know about the age and lifespan of the people, and it is against many other narrations which tell us that no, this is not the case. The imam know about that. At least if they will, they can know about the lifespan of the people. So when we put together all these points, we cannot rely on this narration to prove the authenticity of the dreams of those people who claim to have seen the imams. So this is one narration that the followers of these false claimants adhere to.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one my heart is to.
The second narration is about a person asking Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that a man saw you in a dream, and he is a person who always drinks alcohol. Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam told him that drinking alcohol does not remove his faith, his iman. Rather, what he makes him out of faith is that if he leaves us, if he disobeys us. This is one of the narrations that these people adhere to. It has been mentioned in the book Al-Ikhtisas, page 90. Again, the narrators, some of the narrators of this narration are unknown, majhul, or they are weak. So we put aside altogether this narration.
Right.
We cannot rely on it at all. Second of all, it tells us that a man who always drinks alcohol, he can see the imam. And imam says that this is not a problem. The problem is that if he disobeys us, so already he is disobeying you by drinking alcohol. So this is another problem with the narration. And the third point is the one that we mentioned before. It is talking about a person who already has seen Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. And now when he sees him in a dream, he is sure that this is not the Satan. He is the imam, because he knows the image of the imam. So for us, poor people living in the time of the major occultation, we cannot refer to this narration to prove the authenticity of our dreams, because we do not know about the face and image of the imams. There are many other narrations, they are similar in content. In another case, a man had a problem with his tongue. He had a kind of illness in his tongue. He saw Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam in a dream, and Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam told him about a medicine for this
ailment,
illness.
Right.
Yeah. When he woke up, he didn't pay attention to his dream, according to this narration.
So this man was contemporary to Imam al-Ridha?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So later he saw Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam in Nishabur, when Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam was coming from Medina to Tus. He saw Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam and told him that I have this problem, I have this illness, please give me some medicine. Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam told him that I have done already. I told you in the dream that you have, this is your medicine and you have to act upon that. This narration is mentioned in Uyun Akhbar al-Ridha, volume 2, page 211. So again, as you rightly mentioned, it is talking about a person who has seen the Imam, who knows the face and image of the Imam, and it does not apply to our time. Secondly, when it comes to the chain of the narration, all the narrators of these narration are unknown and majhul. So again, we cannot rely on this narration. So these are the narrations which talk about seeing an infallible Imam or Prophet in the dream by those people who, when they were awake, they had seen the Imam.
Right.
So we cannot adhere to these narrations to prove the authenticity of the dreams of the people who have not seen the
so
Prophet.
It doesn't apply to our time.
Yeah,
in
these
conclusion.
Narrations. But
right.
Then we have other narrations that these people adhere to, and if you have time, we can begin to talk about those narrations in this program.
Regarding the authenticity of dreams that some may have, basically we divide it into two categories. It is of those who have seen the infallibles and can directly recognize the face of the infallible in their own dreams. And then there's a case of, as you said, us unprivileged people whom have not had the honor of seeing the infallibles themselves, and the situation changes for us entirely. But then again, you said that even for those who have seen the Imams, it still depends on the context and the interpretation of that dream.
That's true.
So either way, basically, you can't base anything on dreams.
That's
in a nutshell, right? So if there is anything you would like to add in this regard, I would be more than happy to hear.
Sure. So these narrations were about those people who lived at the time of the infallibles, and then they saw the dream, and we analyzed these narrations. But then the followers of these false claimants, they say that we have some narrations which include us unprivileged people as well. According to these narrations, whoever sees the Imam or the Prophet, it cannot be the Satan. It is the Prophet or the Imam, even those people who have not seen the infallibles. So we need to analyze these few narrations one after the other, because this is the most important part of our discussion.
Right.
Those narrations which tell us that if you see the Prophet, even if you have not seen the Prophet, but if the, in the dream you are told that this is the Prophet, this is the Imam, you have seen the Prophet and the Imam. It cannot be the Satan. The first narration, Sheikh As-Saduq, one of the greatest Shia scholars, says that we are told in some narrations that if a person sees the Prophet or one of the Imams in his dreams, whoever, whether at the time of the presence of the infallibles or after that, and see that they have entered a land. In the dream, he sees that the Prophet or the Imam, they have entered a land. The interpretation of this dream is that that land would be safe, and they will have so much blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the continuation of the narration. This narration has been mentioned by Sheikh As-Saduq in Kamaluddin, volume 1, page 210. So the problem with this narration is about the chain of the narration. Sheikh As-Saduq does not mention any chain of the narration for this narration, which tell us that we cannot rely on this narration at all. And the content of this narration has not been mentioned in any other narration as well. So this is the only narration which talk about this issue. And the third point is that even if we have such narrations, it talks about the case in which we are sure that the person and the Imam that we have seen in the dream is the Prophet or the Imam. But through these narrations, we cannot prove that. We have to adhere to other narrations. We have to, resort to other narrations, which tell us that Satan cannot come into the form of the Prophet or the Imam, and we will discuss about them. So this narration in and of itself cannot prove anything.
Right, of course. Thank you so very much for your time, brother. That was
My pleasure.
Enlightening discussion. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us on this episode of The Last Savior. Inshallah ta'ala, we'll be discussing more of such topics in the future. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjaj bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
Welcome to the program. Just when things started to go right for Boeing, having recertified its troubled Boeing 737 MAX, new allegations have surfaced, casting doubts on the process to restore the aircraft to the flight line. The article you're about to hear under the heading, New Concerns Emerge After 737 MAX Recertification, has been authored by Dave McKechock. Stay tuned, please, for more on this topic. Just when things started to go right for Boeing, having recertified its troubled Boeing 737 MAX, new allegations have surfaced, casting doubt on the process to restore the aircraft to the flight line. The Verge has reported that Boeing and the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, worked together to manipulate 737 MAX recertification tests following two fatal crashes in 2018 and 2019, according to a new Senate report. Boeing inappropriately coached some FAA test pilots to reach a desired outcome during the recertification test, and some were even performed on simulators that weren't equipped to recreate the same conditions as the crashes. In doing this, the Senate report's authors say the FAA and Boeing were attempting to cover up important information that may have contributed to the 737 MAX tragedies, The Verge reported. The FAA is also accused of retaliating against whistleblowers, possibly obstructing the Office of Inspector General's investigation into the crashes, failing to hold senior managers accountable, and allowing Southwest Airlines to operate improperly certified planes. The 102-page report was compiled by the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation and is built on information from 50 whistleblowers, FAA staff interviews, and more than 15,000 pages of documents. All MAX planes were grounded worldwide after crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia killed a total of 346 people in October 2018 and March 2019. Last month, the FAA approved the 737 MAX return to service, and flights have resumed in Brazil. According to a whistleblower who was an FAA safety inspector, Boeing representatives watched and gave advice to help test pilots in a flight simulator respond to a nose-down pitch of the plane in a few seconds. The reaction of three flight crews was still slower than Boeing had assumed. According to the report, each time the plane would have been thrown into a nose-down pitch, although recovery would have been possible, the investigator said. Our findings are troubling, Senator Roger Wicker, who chairs the committee, said in a statement. The report details a number of significant examples of lapses in aviation safety oversight and failed leadership in the FAA. It is clear that the agency requires consistent oversight to ensure the work to protect the flying public is executed fully and correctly. The FAA countered that it was an FAA pilot who discovered a separate computer issue in the plane, a flaw that took Boeing additional months to fix. Investigators also said an FAA division manager was first invited, then excluded from a review of the MAX crashes, even though his position normally would call for him to participate in the review. The official said he believes he was excluded to shield the FAA from criticism. Boeing has said that it takes seriously the committee's findings and will continue to review the report in full. The FAA said it was carefully reviewing the document, which the committee acknowledges contains a number of unsubstantiated allegations. The agency added that it is confident that the safety issues that played a role in the tragic accidents have been addressed through the design changes required and independently approved by the FAA and its partners. The report also noted Southwest Airlines was able to operate more than 150,000 flights carrying 17.2 million passengers on jets without confirmation that required maintenance had been completed. The Senate report said the Southwest flights put millions of passengers at potential risk. Southwest did not immediately comment. The 737 MAX was rushed through the development so Boeing could keep pace with rival Airbus, which had surprised announced a more fuel-efficient plane in 2011. Instead of developing a new plane from the ground up, Boeing modified the 737NG with bigger, more fuel-efficient engines. The placement of those engines made the plane susceptible to stalls in certain takeoff situations, though, so Boeing equipped the plane with a piece of software that would automatically pitch the nose down to prevent this from happening. Boeing didn't tell regulators or customers about the software, though, in a bid to cut down on costly flight training. This left the pilots of Lion Air Flight 610 in 2018 and Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 in 2019 fighting, and ultimately losing out to a piece of software they didn't know was working against them. That software, known as Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, that is MCAS, was a big focus of the recertification tests following the two crashes, especially in simulators meant to recreate the crash conditions. The problem broadly that the Commerce Committee found was that this testing process was rife with its own problems. Some FAA investigators left tests early, while others were performed in simulators that weren't equipped with the same software that doomed the 737 MAX flights, meaning the results were meaningless. In one particular FAA test performed on the Wright simulator, a whistleblower says Boeing officials were present and told the test pilots when to hit the switch that killed MCAS. When these actions were reported by whistleblowers, they were often ignored or retaliated against, according to the report.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel, something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with the Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takravanchi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons, which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takravanchi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after the foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that it will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
All flights and trains coming from the United Kingdom have been barred from entering Europe. Other countries, including Canada, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and Morocco, have also suspended flights to and from the UK for 48 hours or more. Britons have been rattled by the Prime Minister's announcement that Christmas visits will have to be cancelled because of the new COVID-19 strain. And now there are growing fears the country will run out of fresh food in the days before Christmas because of freight and transport disruption. The government insists there's nothing to be worried about, though, and that ahead of Brexit, the government is fully prepared.
It's vital first to stress that these delays, which are only occurring at Dover, only affect human-handled freight, and that is only 20% of the total arriving from or departing to the European continent, which means the vast majority of food, medicines and other supplies are coming and going as normal.
The British government is dealing with an escalating public health crisis, deepening economic upheaval and Brexit trade talks in Brussels simultaneously. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's handling of all three crises has come under fire and faith in the government is waning.
It's just got to a point where now people are just going to feel like their freedom is being restricted and their basic sort of human rights, and it's spending millions of pounds on an app that doesn't even work. So, I mean, yeah, making promises they can't adhere to. So I think, yeah, they've really shot themselves in the foot.
They're doing an okay job. I think obviously they could probably do better. But, you know, I think it's always easy when you're looking on the outside in, going, you know, we'd do this or that.
No more promises that we'll be over this by such and such a date, a day at a time now. I mean, it's a difficult situation for the government. But no more promises. We'll be over this by Christmas, Easter, a day at a time. It's debatable. Who would want to be in the government situation at the moment? It's changing by the day worldwide.
I think, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would as people to think about, you know, what would they have actually, what would they have done if they had been faced with everything that has happened? Because I don't necessarily think that there's one right course of action. I don't necessarily think that our government have handled it the perfect way, but what is the perfect way kind of thing? And I don't think people have helped themselves by rebelling against the rules and all of that kind of thing. So
people are going to complain no matter what Boris Johnson says or does. So
the new strain of COVID-19 has already been detected in the Netherlands, Denmark, Belgium and Iceland. On the upside, the scientists are saying the new strain is not resistant to the vaccines now being approved and administered. More than 500,000 people have received the Pfizer jab in the UK, which was the first country to approve it, and Europe's medicine regulators have approved it as well, which means inoculations will be underway across the bloc in a matter of days. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Yemen scholars came together in the capital Sana'a to condemn some Arab states for normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. They said with signing normalization deals with Israel, these states have betrayed the Palestinians.
We've announced the continuous processes of normalization of ties with the Zionist entity. We are here to warn other Arab states not to follow the same path. Any normalization deal amounts to the betrayal of the blood of the martyrs who sacrificed their lives to protect the occupied lands against Israeli aggression.
Morocco has been the last Arab state to normalize ties with Israel after Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan over the past months.
The scholars of Yemen reiterate their opposition to any recognition of the Zionist enemy. We believe that it amounts to betrayal of the Muslim values. This will pave the way for further aggression against the Palestinians.
The normalization deals have already sparked outrage among the public and the Muslim world, where pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Meanwhile, Palestinians from all political factions have been unanimous in their condemnation of the normalization deals. They seek an independent state in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip with the East Jerusalem Al-Quds as its capital. So the normalization, they say, serves as betrayal of their cause.
Yemeni scholars voiced their support for the Palestinians, warning Arab world to adopt a united stance against Israeli aggression. They say the normalization deals will only embolden Israel to press ahead with its oppressive policies against the Palestinians. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The news was delivered Saturday that the southeast and east of England, including the capital London, were descending into Tier 4 COVID-19 restrictions. This was sparked by the discovery of a new variant of the virus that is up to 70% more transmittable.
Given the early evidence we have on this new variant of the virus, the potential risk it poses, it is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with Christmas as planned. In England, those living in Tier 4 areas should not mix with anyone outside their own household at Christmas, though support bubbles will remain in place for those at particular risk of loneliness or isolation.
After the announcement, chaos ensued as people scrambled to leave ahead of the midnight deadline. People bundled up presents and essentials and set out hoping to save their Christmas plans after England's Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty suggested they unpack.
I want to put some numbers out there because I think that helps to explain why I'm going to give the answer that I'm going to give. But my short answer would be, please unpack it at this stage.
Officials say that the ban on Tier 4 Christmas visits is unenforceable. And to make things worse, hundreds of flights were cancelled after the UK's closest allies cut transport with it due to fears about the new COVID-19 strain. The decision meant closing off the UK's most important artery with mainland Europe. A step British Transport Minister Grant Shapps said was surprising, especially as, according to him, the new strain is already in continental Europe.
We tend to be more aware of the variants faster, and there have been thousands of variants of coronavirus. It's just that the particular one that we've seen in Kent and London, the thing which has led to the Tier 4 lockdown, is a particularly virulent variant of the virus. So it means that it spreads more easily. We've detected that first, but we know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries.
The chaos hit just days before the United Kingdom was due to exit the EU's orbit with or without a trade deal.